The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. And this evening I'd like to give the third of my three-part talks on the Buddha. And the idea being that the Buddha was a very important person for Buddhism, and it might be interesting to consider him a little bit more and a little bit what the tradition says about him. And as I've been saying these evenings, is that it's relatively difficult to actually know much about the Buddha. There's a tremendous body of myth that has arisen about him, and so some of that myth speaks wonderful truths, or speak about things which are quite meaningful to people who hear these stories, these myths, and some people are turned off by the stories and the myths. They're just too, they seem to make this person into more of a superman or a god than a human being that can be an example to others. Before I talk about him, I want to point out that the literature, the texts that survive, that talk about the Buddha, for many people, including myself, when I was first introduced to it, I found it actually quite boring to read. And, you know, it put me to sleep. But slowly, over the years, in studying it, I've learned to have a tremendous appreciation for this body of literature that survives. And one of the things that is not obvious for the people who haven't studied ancient Indian literature of the time is how amazingly unique these ancient records are. Even if they don't really record what the Buddha was actually like, whoever it is that kind of composed these and edited them did something that was very, very different from anything India had seen up to that time. And at least the literature that survives from ancient India, the Vedas, the Upanishads, some of the Jain texts that might be almost as old, they are mostly written in kind of pretty in mythic language, in philosophical language. They're poems, but most importantly, they're just declarative statements. There's a lot of declare, this is the truth. Here it is for you. And what you have in this early literature of the Buddhist literature is you don't have as many declarative statements like this is what the truth is, but rather you have recorded a lot of dialogue. The Buddha goes out and about town, he runs into someone, they have a discussion, someone challenges him, and the Buddha responds. And the Buddha sometimes will sit down and give a talk to his monastics, but most of the record is not the Buddha actually going out to teach and say this is what's happening, but rather records an encounter the Buddha has with other people. And occasionally the Buddha initiates the conversations, but mostly in this ancient record, other people initiated with him. And you have many times what seems like a very human kind of dialogue. It seems like almost like a report, like you can imagine having that discussion yourself almost, except for some of the stylistic ways in which people spoke that back then, or at least how it was written down. And so you find, for some reason, the people who preserve this body of literature preserved it in such a way they're trying to record actual events of someone's life, as opposed to some cosmological myths, some kind of, or some great philosophical ideas about what the truth is. And some people have pointed out that the way the Buddha seems to teach is often Socratic, that there's kind of a question-and-answer kind of approach, where someone asks him a question, sometimes the Buddha does a counter-question to the question he's given, and he kind of helps and supports people or challenges people in this kind of discussion and dialogue. So it has a kind of a much more human quality, like it could be someone who actually, oftentimes, you know, someone we could actually meet. So I want to give an example of one of these encounters that the Buddha, that the tradition records of the Buddha. And perhaps it'll seem a little bit more interesting now that you've been told how you're very unique. It's like, at least with the record that survives, nothing like this exists from India, before the Common Era. So it's not the way that things are preserved in ancient India. So at one time, there was a monk, Venerable Vakali, and he was sick, afflicted, gravely ill. And the Venerable, this monk Vakali, addressed his attendants, "Come, friends, approach the Buddha, pay homage to him in my name, and say, 'Venerable Sir, the Bhikkhu Vakali is sick, afflicted, gravely ill. He pays homage to the Blessed One.' Then say, 'It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Blessed One would approach the Bhikkhu Vakali out of compassion.'" So that's like a pretty, relatively ordinary thing. I mean, you can imagine this monk is sick. He's very sick, it says. People get sick all the time. So there's nothing unusual about that. And he would like his teacher to come and see him. It's not an unusual thing. You have a spiritual teacher, you have a mentor, you have a good friend, and you'd like them to come to see him, come to see you, so that he's asking for this, please send for the Buddha. So his attendants say, yes, friend. And they go to the Buddha and say these things. And then the Buddha does this. He goes to see Vakali. And when the Venerable Vakali saw the Buddha coming in the distance, he stirred in his bed. The Buddha said to him, "Enough, Vakali, do not stir in your bed. There are these seats ready, I will sit down here." So also it's pretty, like his teacher comes, he had a lot of respect for him. He says, I can't be laying in bed, I have to get up and do something. He says, no, don't, you're sick. Stay there and rest. I will just take a seat here. The Buddha sat down and said to the Venerable Vakali, "I hope you are bearing up, Vakali. I hope you're getting better." Did the Buddha actually say this? Is this a myth that was created? Later tradition wanted to kind of depict the Buddha as someone who said, "Are you getting better?" Maybe so. Maybe it's just a fiction, but it's pretty realistic fiction. "I hope that your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that their subsiding, not their increase, is to be discerned." Vakali said, "Venerable Sir, I am not bearing up. I am not getting better. Strong, painful feelings are increasing in me, not subsiding, and their increase, not their subsiding, is to be discerned." He's getting worse. So that's also a pretty reasonable thing. There was very little modern medicine back then, or none, no modern medicine. And they had medicine the monks were allowed medicines like oil and ghee, honey and urine. So with those kinds of medicine, probably didn't help that often. So he's sick, he's getting worse. Also a pretty ordinary human thing in many ways, so it's not the report is nothing remarkable. "I hope then, Vakali, that you are not troubled by remorse and regret." So he's getting worse physically. So then Buddha says, "Well, I hope at least you're not troubled psychologically with remorse and regret." "Indeed, Venerable Sir, I have quite a lot of remorse and regret." So sometimes people are dying, and one of the things that people who minister to the dead is to ask them, "Is there anything unresolved in your life?" And sometimes there is a lot of regret and remorse, and people need to do a process of forgiveness or to reconcile with someone and do something. So it's a reasonable question to ask, caring for someone who might even be dying. And he says, "I have a lot of remorse and regret." "I hope, Vakali," the Buddha said, "that you have nothing for which to reproach yourself in regard to virtue." So he's saying, well, in terms of regret and remorse, I hope it isn't because of your bad virtue, that you've done something unethical. And Vakali says, "I have nothing for which to reproach myself in regard to virtue." Then Vakali, If you have nothing for which to reproach yourself in regard to virtue, why are you troubled by remorse and regret? And Vakali says, for a long time, Venerable Sir, I have wanted to come to see the Blessed One, but I haven't been fit enough to do so. So here he's been sick for a long time. He really wants to see his teacher, and that's what he has regrets about, that he hasn't been able to go see his teacher and get teachings and support. Seems also to be a relatively human kind of encounter that this should happen. Then the Buddha says something very powerful. And as I read this to you, you have to remember the context of him meeting and talking to someone who is quite sick, physically struggling, maybe dying. Because what Vakali said was, I have wanted to come to see the Blessed One. So, the Buddha says, enough, Vakali. Why do you want to see this foul body? So, saying, why do you want to see this foul body? Now, does the Buddha just have this kind of really downer kind of attitude towards the body? The body's a, you know, or is he saying this out of compassion for someone whose body is really sick and who understands, don't come to see me. See me physically, why do you want to just see me? Now in India sometimes, in ancient India, seeing the guru, darshan, was considered very important. So when he says, I want to see the teacher, he wants to see the, you know, actually seeing is important. Not. So it's quite a powerful thing to say in the context of someone who's maybe over-enamored or overly interested in doing this darshan of the seeing of the teacher. Why do you want to see this foul body? It's been said the Buddha was quite handsome. So, Buddha says, why this foul body? Then the Buddha says, one who sees the Dharma sees me. One who sees me sees the Dharma. For in seeing the Dharma, Vakali, one sees me. In seeing me, one sees the Dharma. So, as I understand this, is that the Buddha is deflecting the attention away from himself and saying, seeing the guru is not really that important. And he does it in a very dramatic way by saying this foul body. What's important is to see the Dharma. And if you see the Dharma, I think the emphasis here is he's trying to say, if you see the Dharma, you see me. Because what the Buddha is, what the Buddha is about, is the Dharma. That's what he was trying to teach. That's what his whole, once he became a teacher, conveying the Dharma, the truth, that's what he was interested in. And what you see in this ancient record that's preserving, you know, these supposedly teachings of the Buddha, you find pretty consistently, over and over and over again, that the Buddha engages in conversations with people, or sometimes gives a Dharma talk and teachings, not to give philosophy, not to just teach for the sake of teaching what the truth is, but he's teaching in order to have an effect on the people he is talking to help to lead them onward or support them to become liberated and free. What's important is not their... So it's this movement towards liberation. And often in these dialogues, he doesn't even initiate them, but people come with a problem, with difficulty, and he tries to engage and help them and support them to move them in the direction of liberation, as if that's the most important thing to do. There was one scholar who pointed out that the Buddha attitude towards life was, if it's not broken, don't fix it. What's it, how do you say, if it ain't broken, don't fix it? So, and so you find that the Buddha doesn't kind of give big teachings about how wonderful things are or the nature of what liberation is, but rather, if someone comes and has a problem, has suffering, he's interested in addressing that problem. So, rather than governing by high political ideals, you govern by engineering the particular problems that come your way. Because that's what they say was Obama was going to do compared to the previous administration. So the Buddha was more this kind of, you know, you meet the problem of the moment and try to take care of that. If it's not a problem, you need to teach, you need to do anything at all. And so sometimes the Buddha's teaching can seem kind of negative because he's always seemingly addressing the problem that people have. Because if not a problem, why, you know, then it's everything's okay. Leave it alone. And so I kind of compare it to that, like of a doctor. You go to a doctor, and the doctor asks you, you know, how are the Yankees doing? And wasn't that quite something, you know, that play the other day and the ump, how he missed the call and this and that. And you know, you have, you know, 10 minutes with the doctor, you know, and the doctor's interested in sports and you're in sport, you know, and you look at your watch. And finally, you just kind of tell the doctor, look, I'm here because I'm sick. And I want you to be interested in me being that I'm sick, you know. So, you know, no one complains about a doctor who's interested in the fact that you're sick. That's what you want them to do. So the Buddha was kind of like a physician that way. That's what he was interested in. But so it gives a little kind of, you know, because the Buddha's kind of like a doctor, you know, it can get a certain kind of slant on the impression that he might give to people. So for the Buddha, the idea was to see the Dharma, and the Dharma is that which liberates, which frees us from suffering, frees us from the problems that we have. And this was such a strong emphasis for him, the Dharma and seeing that liberative Dharma, that before he died, he refused to appoint someone to be his heir, to be someone who would, he was the kind of the leader of the monastic order, leader of the kind of the Buddhists of his time, because he was the founder of it all, but he declined to make someone else the leader after he died. And he said that now you should make the Dharma your teacher. So the Dharma itself, so again, deflecting it from any individual and pointing to the truth as the teacher. In fact, you find periodically in the ancient literature, people would somewhat spontaneously, or they'd hear the Buddha teach, and they'd be so impressed by him and what he had to teach that they would declare that they were going for refuge in the Buddha. I go for refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. It seems that this was an ancient kind of ritual formula that people did when they wanted to align themselves with a spiritual teacher or with a maybe even with a powerful warlord or someone. They would go for refuge to that person. And so they were following a custom of the time. And it seemed the Buddha just went along with that. He didn't see that people did that. He was fine with it. As far as I know, there's no record of the Buddha encouraging anybody to go for refuge with him. It doesn't show any interest that he wanted people to do that. But before he died, he said something very interesting. And something that apparently he'd never said before, in the records at least. And something that I think it was very unusual also in the history of the times. In the days before he died, he said, now that I'm going to die, you should make yourself your own refuge. So rather than the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, you should be your own refuge. Rather than looking for another leader, find the truth, find the ability to find truth in yourself. It's a very powerful statement, especially, you know, for a tradition that says, you know, emphasize is not self. But that's to confuse the two different categories of self being talked about here. So just in a kind of easy, colloquial way, you know, make yourself a refuge. Make yourself a kind of person make yourself into the kind of person that allows you to find the truth, allows you to become free from the suffering that this life brings. So that when you become sick, afflicted, and your pain increases, that you can find in yourself relief, freedom, release, and don't have to look for it elsewhere in the great challenges of life. And then the Buddha said, make yourself a refuge, make yourself in English, most English translators prefer this translation, make yourself a light. probably heard that before. Make yourself a light. And then it goes on and says, and make the Dharma your refuge. So make yourself your own refuge. Make a refuge out of yourself. Make a light out of yourself. And then make the Dharma your refuge. So not the Buddha. And the Dharma is something you're supposed to be find here in this, in your own heart, perhaps. So it usually says light, but the word dīpa in that ancient language also means island. So make yourself an island, which is probably what he meant, because in many places the Buddha talked about the floods of greed, hate, and delusion that sweep over a person and wipe them out, just like a flood will wipe out a village next to the river. And so you need to find a dry, high island to be safe on from the floods. That was more kind of the analogy he tended to use rather than that of light. But so make yourself, find a place to make yourself safe so that you're not kind of flooded by the suffering that comes from clinging, grasping, hate, fear, greed, hate, and delusion. So again, so turn it towards yourself. Don't look towards the Buddha. The Buddha is there to teach you and help guide you and support you. The Buddha said also powerfully, Buddhas can only point the way. It's up to you to walk the way. It's up for you to practice. So again, back to yourself. So it's quite different from some spiritual traditions where the guru and worshipping the guru, celebrating the guru, getting shakti from the guru, getting something from the guru, where the guru is the path. The Buddha is not the path. He just points to the path. So then we turn, so this is kind of like the suttas. And then there's another early body of literature called the Vinaya. And that's the, Vinaya is kind of the, it's kind of the legalistic document that sets, that writes the monastic rules and regulations for the monks and nuns. And in this legalistic document, it's quite ancient from the time of the Buddha supposedly, it also, in a good legal way, when there's a new rule that the monastics have to follow, it gives the precedent case of why that rule came into being. And here we see the Buddha again. The Buddha didn't lay down rules for the monastics in the abstract. He seemingly only did it if there was a problem. And so if there was a problem, then he said, oh, you got monks, nuns, you can't do that anymore. So, you know, you have to. And there's some pretty wild monks back in the Buddha's time. And so it's mixed with kind of interesting reading some of these stories. Like one of the stories is, that one of the rules, and you can fill in the story with your imagination if you wish, is that a monk cannot place his penis in any orifice that's smaller than the orifice of a chicken. Because, they're supposed to be celibate, right? And so most people don't know, people don't read those kinds of body literature. It's very legalistic now. So what actually happened, back then they required that rule. But there were these monks who didn't quite understand, the decorum, how you behave when you're a monk. So they had to make a rule so they didn't know. And some of these monks were quite wild, and there was a group of monks that were always getting in trouble, and the Buddha was like, okay, a new rule. But what's very interesting is these, because they give the precedent case, it talks a lot about the conditions in the time and the Buddha's response that has a very different flavor than what you find in the suttas of what the Buddha was like and what the monastics were like. And one of the interesting things you find in this Vinaya is that the Buddha changes his mind. Sometimes he lays down a rule, and then someone comes to him and says, this doesn't work so well. And then he says, okay, we'll change it. I'll change it. So, some people would like their Buddha to be omniscient, and there was a lot of discussion in history of Buddhism, was the Buddha omniscient? Was he all-knowing? And then they had to kind of do this complicated discussion about how he was really omniscient when he pretended not to know. Or when he changed his mind, he really knew he was going to change his mind, but he really did it for the sake of the people who had to, you know, learn from him or something. So it's very forced, some of these arguments. I think it's much more natural to think the Buddha changed his mind. Maybe he made a mistake. So one interesting place that maybe the Buddha made a mistake. Is it okay for the Buddha to be a person who makes mistakes? I mean, if you're going to become a Buddhist and follow this man, follow his teachings and you know, the path and the direction he's pointing to, shouldn't he be infallible? And got to have it completely right and be wise and enlightened in all things at all times. So is it okay that he's maybe fallible? Can make mistakes? So here's a story that's kind of dramatic, I think. So the Buddha, supposedly, the way the story is told, the Buddha had a son. And after his son was born, at some point, he left his family to go on spiritual search. Why he did that, he felt this tremendous compulsion to resolve the existential issues that he felt. It's been pointed out that the Buddha lost his mother at a very early age, which for some people is a big trauma that can cause all kinds of things, you know, as an adult, you know, needs, psychological needs that need to be resolved. So maybe that, you know, there was this great burning wound inside of him that needed to be resolved. Who knows? But he did leave. And after he was gone for about 7 years. And after about 6-7 years, he attained his enlightenment. And seemingly, one of the first things he did was he went back home. And when he came back home to his area, to his town, his wife would have nothing to talk to with him. So that's a reasonable thing. You know, she's kind of pissed off. You left me with this kid. But then she tells her son, Rahula, go to your dad and ask for your inheritance. You know, the Buddha just became a monk, renounced everything, so his poor son is not going to get anything. So ask for your inheritance. And so he's 7 years old, Rahula, and he goes to his father, the Buddha, and says, I'd like my inheritance. And the Buddha turns to Sariputta, his right-hand man, his main disciple, and says to Sariputta, ordain him. Because as a Buddha, what he had to pass on was this monastic life, or this path of life that leads to liberation. That was the most important thing he wanted to pass on. So his son became ordained. Well, I wonder how well that went over with a mother. So the Buddha's father came to the Buddha and said, look, he didn't exactly complain, but he asked the Buddha, could you please make a new rule? Can you make a rule? This caused so much distress in the family. Can you please make a rule that no child gets ordained without the permission? It might actually be any monk, not as much a child, but any person at all gets ordained without first getting the permission of their parents. And the Buddha said, yes. So from now on, if a person can get ordained, they need the permission of their parents. So the very thing the Buddha had just done, he decreed should never happen again. So a little bit he makes amends, but, you know, his crime has already been done. Does it make sense? So now, is the Buddha, are we going to forgive him because he was all wise and all knowing and omniscient, he knew which was the right thing to do? Or is it okay to say, well, you know, actually the Buddha kind of blew it there a little bit. You know, he shouldn't have done it that way. Maybe there was still this tension between him and his wife. And so he's, you know, he heard, you know, give me my inheritance. He's okay, I'll give it to her. I don't know, who knows? You know, we don't want our great religious enlightened person to act in ways that seems unenlightened. But can't anybody at all make mistakes? And there's a number of other places where the Buddha changed his mind with the monastic rules. Well, that wasn't exactly. So one example that I like is there was a family that apparently it was a disease came through town and a lot of people died, and the whole family died except for one young child. And so, orphan, what's going to happen to an orphan? And so one of the Buddhist monks took in the orphan to care for him and made him kind of a novice monk. And now how does it go? I forget the story exactly. But there's several stories where they've taken kids who are orphans out of compassion and care, and then these kids grow up in the monastery because who else is going to take care of them? So you don't get a lot of expressions of this compassionate care of orphans in the suttas, but you do in the Vinaya, where you're talking about actually how monks have to regulate their lives. And then it's a story, so he lets them take them in. Now I forget how it goes. But there was one story where... So he lets someone in, and then this young kid, we don't know how old he is, goes with a monk on alms into town. And the town people say, oh, look at that. That's the illegitimate child of that monk. He must have, got it together with one of the nuns. So the Buddha said, I think we need to have a rule here. So he said, you can't ordain a child as a novice until they're 15 years old. So that people don't think that these monks are kind of, having a too wild time. So, okay. And then there was another situation where there was, again, pestilence came through town and the family died, except there were two kids who survived. But they were quite young. So what to do with these two kids? There's no social services back then. And so some of the monks came to the Buddha and said, what do we do with this? Can we ordain these kids? Because you said you have to be 15 to be novices. And the Buddha said, well, can these kids chase away crows? Meaning that they could do something useful, I guess. And the monks, oh yeah, they're old enough to chase away crows. Okay, well in that case, you can ordain them. So now the rules is you have to be old enough to chase away crows to be ordained. So he changed his mind from one to another. What the tradition has come to, most traditions come to understand, is that chase away crows, you have to be 7 or 8 years old. So you can be 7 and be ordained as a novice monk. And then another situation where the Buddha, there's something happens where a monk has two novice students, and those two novice monks do some kind of sexual play with each other, which is not appropriate for monastic types. And so the Buddha makes a rule, one monk can only have one novice student. So they're not all living together, I guess. And then, Sariputta, in the story of Rahula, Sariputta ordained the Buddha's son and kind of became his caretaker. But then there was another situation where I think there was another orphan, and Sariputta said, well, I can't now have another novice monk because you told us we can only have one. And the Buddha said, oh, forget that rule. So again, you don't get the sense of someone who is all-knowing beforehand, but you get a sense of someone who's trial and error, finding his way, problem-solving in the situation itself. In the situation of the moment, he's kind of figuring out what to do and kind of finding his way, as opposed to he's all-wise from the moment he was enlightened, with all things and all concerns. What you'd get, I think, is you get much more of a sense of a human being rather than a god or some great, Superman kind of person. You also find, though, that the Buddha there's a famous story something that you've probably heard it before. It's told many times in our circles. A man comes and walks along the road and runs into the Buddha. And the Buddha looks kind of special, kind of radiant and happy and peaceful. And the man says, he's curious about this Buddha, and he says, you know, what are you? Are you some kind of god? And the Buddha says, no. Are you some kind of spirit? No. Are you some kind of, goes through various categories, are you some kind of spirit, some kind of whatever? And the Buddha says, no, no. And then he finally says, are you a human? And the Buddha says, no. He says, I am awake. So, of course, he's human. But that's not how he identifies himself. The way that the Buddha identifies himself, understands himself, is through the idea of being awake or being aware. This clear, open, alert kind of awareness that comes with awakening. And so the Buddha seldom called himself the Buddha. Buddha is a title. He didn't call himself by his name, given name, Gotama, but he referred to himself as the Tathagata. And the Tathagata is a very interesting term. The Tatha means thus, or such, like thus. Thus it is, thus. And the Gata is usually taken to mean gone, thus gone one. But the Gata also means, the word Gata also has the meaning of being, existing as. So being one who is thus. So if you ask the Buddha, who are you? He might say, I am one who is thus. What does thus mean? Thus it defies definition, defies labels, defies limits. When you say it's thus, it's like this, you're just kind of letting it be as it is without putting any boundaries around it or labels on it or defining it in any way. And the Buddha, one of the things the Buddha said about himself is that it's not possible to discern, to see, to understand the mind of a Buddha. Now, the way I understand that is that if you walk down the street, you can see sometimes the mood people are in. You can see that the preoccupation. You can read things in people. You know, if someone's in a real grumpy mood, and they're walking around grumpy, you kind of say, oh, look at that, grumpiness. Or they're really afraid and timid. You say, oh, look, you can see that person is timid and afraid. Or you see they're really preoccupied by something. You see it sometimes in their face or in the way they behave, that they're preoccupied. When you look at the Buddha, apparently, he was not caught up in anything. He wasn't preoccupied by anything. He wasn't fixated on anything, on any emotion, any state at all. And because he wasn't fixated or focused on something, for the Buddha, you're defined by what you're concerned with, what you're caught up in, what you're preoccupied with. So if you're caught up in your fear, anxiety, that fear defines you. If you're caught up in your anger, the anger defines you. If you're caught up in your desire, the desire defines you. If you're caught up in metaphysical speculation, then that defines you. Someone's caught up in speculation. But if you're not caught up in anything, if the mind is not caught or fixated or preoccupied with anything, then you would have nothing to be defined by. And then you're just thus. There's no need for definition. There's no need to be anybody. There's no need to be an identity. So here in the West, sometimes we say a person's defined maybe by their identity, by their role, or how they see themselves. You know, I'm beautiful, I'm a carpenter, I'm a
big bank account. I'm my car. I'm my clothes. I'm, you know, my wise opinions. So as we define ourselves that way, and you can say, oh, that person has that, you know, it has those opinions or whatever. But if you have no identity, if you don't fixate and held by any identity, then you defy being defined by an identity. So the Buddha had kind of an identity, you know, he was a renunciant, a spiritual teacher. But in his own mind, if you look in his mind, if you could look into his mind, he would not be defined by that. So the Buddha called himself one who is thus. And so one who is thus is difficult to define in normal kind of ordinary human terms. But one who is thus is also not meant to be someone who's superhuman. Rather, it's someone who is extraordinarily ordinary. And I like the idea of ordinary. So there's a famous Zen koan that someone asked the teacher, what is Buddha? And the answer is ordinary mind. So maybe there's nothing extraordinary about being a Buddha, but perhaps it's more the absence. It's nothing special to be a Buddha, but it's the absence of preoccupation, fixation, identification, absence of the mind caught. And is that something that's possible for us? I think the reason why Buddhism survived and became, why Buddhism became Buddhism, this whole tradition arose, was not just because of what the Buddha had to teach, the teachings he gave, but had a lot to do with how the Buddha inspired people who met him. That he was a man who was transformed. And there's perhaps the sense of peace, of freedom, of radiance, of joy that comes when the mind is not defined by anything, not fixated on anything, is deeply meaningful for people who see that and encounter that. It points to a possibility that is also possible for us. And so I believe that when people encountered the Buddha, they saw a possibility. And enough people pursued that possibility and discovered it for themselves as well. And so to be respectful of what the Buddha was teaching, to listen to what the Buddha was teaching, is not to memorize what he had to teach and parrot it back as being this is the truth because it's the Buddha had to teach. But to respect and follow what he has to teach is for us to also discover in our that potential possibility for freedom, for liberation in our own hearts and mind. And if enough of us can do it, then we will then be able to pass it on to the next generation, which I think is one of the greatest gifts we can pass on. So, I hope these 3 weeks on the Buddha were useful, interesting, and I hope that perhaps the Buddha remains someone who can inspire us to forget him by becoming Buddhas ourselves. Thank you.